Roger was annoyed by the Dream Team crack, but all he said was, "I haven't said a word to Henrietta." "Yeah, and she'll probably never forgive you later on. And there's Farik Fannin and his buddies. The cannon doesn't strike me as any rock of restraint, either. That kid is such a jerk."
"What do you mean?"
"What do I mean? That cretin thinks he's doing you a terrific favor by allowing you to get close enough to see the little diamonds in his ears."
Roger was alarmed.
"Well, I'll grant you—"
"Don't worry," said the mayor, "don't worry.
At City Hall we don't subtract points from anybody for being a jerk. I just want you to understand that I don't know how long you can realistically count on this thing remaining secret. There's also the girl. What's her name? Elizabeth? Elizabeth Armholster. She's got friends, no doubt. And Armholster. He's a hot-headed old tub of lard. I can't imagine him keeping this thing to himself for very long."
"All the more reason to talk to him sooner rather than later, Wes."
Wes Jordan eyed him from above a cynical and reproachful smile. "Kindly tell your colleagues that what I do I will do quickly. Tell them that you, the mayor's old pal, have successfully engaged the mayor." Then his face grew as hard and serious as Roger had ever seen it. "And tell them that whatever I do, it will not be with the interests of your client or of the House of Armholster in mind. I will act solely in the interests of the city." Roger waited for a telltale twist of the lips. That never came. Chapter 5. The Suicidal Freezer Unit. The Kroger Global Foods warehouse in the San Francisco Bay Area is not in any part of the fabled Bay Area that ever stole the heart of a songwriter. Or, as far as that goes, a travel writer. Not even a travel writer desperate for something different to write about. No, the Kroger warehouse is on the wrong side of the bay, the east side. Not the San Francisco side, but the Oakland side, up toward El Cerrito, in Contra Costa County, just off the marshes in the flatlands. On those magical evenings in San Francisco when the fog rolls in from the Pacific Ocean, and people emerge from the hotels on Nob Hill, and go for brave walks down the staggeringly steep slopes of Powell Street, and shiver deliciously in the chilly air, and listen to the happy clapper-clangor of the cable cars, and the mournful foghorns of the freighters heading out to sea, and all at once life is a lovely little operetta from the year 1910. At that moment, likely as not, barely 5 miles to the east, a brutal sun has been roasting Contra Costa County for 13 or 14 hours, and the roof of the Kroger warehouse is still swimming in caloric waves. Even though the stars are out and the mercury remains swollen up to 90 degrees, down from 104 at 3 p.m., and the employees' parking lot, which is dirt, has been cooked to cinders until it's as parched, pocked, dusty, and godforsaken as the surface of Mars. In short, Kroger Global Foods is part of the engine room, the heavy plumbing, the industrial hardpan of this Elysian littoral, known as the San Francisco Bay Area. At about 8:45 on just such an evening, a young man named Conrad Hensley drove into the employees' parking lot at Kroger behind the wheel of a Hyundai hatchback family wagon. Since he was wearing a full set of long johns beneath his flannel shirt and jeans, he had the air conditioning roaring away on the high setting. He cruised up and down 6 or 7 rows of cars, churning up quite a swirl of dust as he went, and finally found a spot over by a cyclone fence with razor wire on top. Behind the fence, against a vast California sky bursting with stars, he could see the silhouettes of a sewage substation, the smokestack of the Bulka rendering works, the pilings of a freeway spur that was under construction, and, coming toward him, overhead, low enough to touch, it seemed like,
the big belly of an airplane grumbling along the glide path to the Oakland International Airport. Such was the view on this side of the scenic San Francisco Bay. He opened the door of his little car, slid out, stood up, and turned his eyes away from the raw floodlights on the roof of the warehouse. He put his hands on his hips and rocked his torso, like an athlete loosening up before a match. At a glance, he might have passed for an athlete. He was tall enough and young enough, and he looked strong enough despite his slight build. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up, and his forearms bulged beneath the long johns, tapering down to hands with long fingers that had been delicate just 6 months ago, but were now so muscular, his wedding ring bit into the flesh like a cinch. How he would ever get it off, if he had to, was a good question. With his dark eyes and long dark eyelashes, his fair skin and delicate lips, he had the sort of face that made people wonder if he wasn't French or Spanish or Italian or Portuguese or Greek or something else sort of Mediterranean. Or, to put it another way, he looked almost too pretty. For that reason, he had grown the droopy mustache that young men grow in hopes of appearing older and graver and, well, tougher. His shirt and faded jeans were the standard uniform of vast legions of young California males who worked down below the managerial level, but his were so meticulously pressed you could see the creases, even in the shirt. Obviously, Conrad Hensley was a young man who wanted order in his life. In the next moment, however, this vision of clean-cut, athletic, sort of Mediterranean orderliness began to wilt. With his flannel shirt and his long johns on, he was already burning up. At least 20 trucks, perhaps as many as 30, were over at the loading dock. Big, white trucks with Croker in enormous letters on the sides. And the rage of the engines and the air brakes hurt his head. The flatulent sighs of the air brakes were what bothered him most of all. But he only needed a little push. He slumped back into the Hyundai, into the driver's seat. His shoulders and his lower back began to ache. His sinuses felt congested, and so he snuffled and spit out the open door of the car. This was his central nervous system rebelling against the immediate future, which was 8 more hours in the suicidal freezer unit. His mouth fell open slightly, and his eyes began to gaze far beyond the cyclone fence, far beyond the Bolka rendering works and the freeway pilings and the San Francisco Bay and the California littoral. It was the sort of look people get when they are about to consider what insignificant specks they are in the immense and incomprehensible scheme of things, if indeed there is any scheme at all. "You baby have a baby!" No doubt Suki had forgotten she ever said it, but Conrad couldn't get it out of his mind. "You baby have a baby!" Before supper, he and Jill had gone over to Suki's 24-hour mini-mart with the children. Jill had Christy in her arms, and he was walking with Carl. And Suki herself, who was at the checkout, had broken into a big smile and exclaimed, "You baby have a baby!" It took a moment before he realized what she was saying, which was, "Your baby's having babies!" His face had turned hot. He was so embarrassed. But what could he say? Here was a Cambodian woman who could barely speak English, a hearty woman who liked him, seemed to like him a great deal, in fact. Then why did he feel so insulted? Because she was so close to the truth. "Your baby's having babies." He and Jill were both 23, and Jill looked about 16, and they had no business having 2 children, not in this day and age, and half the time Jill was like a third baby. But he chided himself for even thinking that. It was no use bringing Jill down. What would he have left? There was nobody else in the world he could fall back on. Not a single solitary soul. Other people had their mom or dad or some relative somewhere. But they hit up on him. In the 6 months since he'd had this job at Croker Global Foods, both his mom and his dad, separately, hadn't spoken to each other for 7 years. Both of them had tried to hit him up for loans. Loans. They talked about his $14 an hour in a wholesale food warehouse as if it were all the money in the world. Well, in a way it was, for somebody in his position. Even though he knew it was a pointless exercise, he sat there in his rattling old Hyundai, tallying his mistakes all over again. If he hadn't gotten Jill pregnant when they were both 18, if he hadn't insisted on marrying her, if they hadn't gone ahead and had 2 children, he could have gone on to San Francisco State, or perhaps even Berkeley, instead of having to settle for 2 years at Mount Diablo Community College. By now he could have been embarked on a real career. The one dream he had left now was that they, Conrad Hensley and family, were going to live in a home they owned themselves, a condo in Danville. In his mind, as he sat here in the Hyundai, he could see Danville. A lovely, leafy little town with pretty houses and pretty shops. An oasis, not all that far from the dump they were renting now. Today, being payday, meant another $150 he could put aside, bringing the total to $4,622.85. The figures were already in his head, down to the penny. Another 12 months, and he'd have a shot at a down payment. A condo in Danville. He looked over at the warehouse. At night, like this, it was an enormous silhouette hulking behind the lights. A monster. His dad had no idea what he did in the warehouse for his $14 an hour. He hadn't even asked. His dad had never had a real job in this life. His father's face came bubbling up into his brain. The beard, the ponytail, both shot through with gray. The soft, sallow flesh. His dad wouldn't last 10 minutes in the freezer unit at Croker Global Foods. With that, Conrad had a terrible premonition. Suppose something happened in there tonight. Suppose he was crippled. Then what? The big Japanese from San Francisco, the one they called Sumo, had wrenched his back doing practically nothing. And now he couldn't walk. Last week, one of the Okies, Junior Fry, had had his ankle crushed by a pallet sliding across a patch of ice. A steady pain seized Conrad's lower back, and his sinuses became so congested they began to ache. He had never felt this bad at the start of the shift. Something was definitely wrong. Why didn't he just drive to a payphone and call in sick? And blow it off? Pickers did it all the time. Ah, pull yourself together. Be a man. But thump, but thump, but thump, but thump. A beat came pounding across the parking lot. Conrad glanced into the rearview mirror and saw a tornado of dust tearing along one of the rows of cars near the entrance. In a moment, the higher frequencies reached him. A crazy skirl of electric guitars and a chorus of raw-throated young male voices screaming, "What?" sounded like, "Brain dead, brain dead, brain dead, brain dead." In no time the tornado seemed to be right on top of him, and there was no mistaking the insane screams, "Brain dead, brain dead, brain dead, brain dead." The funnel of dust, lit a feverish yellow by the floodlights, came roaring around the last line of cars at a crazy speed. A terrific yowling. But thump, brain dead. Conrad twisted about in his seat just in time to see the car fishtail in the dirt behind him with a tremendous shower of dust, and then shoot straight at him and his open door. Terrified, he doubled up and recoiled into the seat. In the next moment, it was all over, with the car parked right beside his somehow, just inches from his door's outer edge. The engine shut off, the yowling music was shut off, and a great illuminated dirty yellow cloud of dust was settling over everything. His ears were ringing. His heart was flailing away. What idiot! Emerging from the car, a very low, bright red car with a rakishly swept back windshield in front and an airfoil wing in the rear, was a creature with a long neck, a bulging Adam's apple, and a baseball cap. The filthy silhouette straightened up in the haze. It was one of his mates in the freezer unit. Furious, Conrad sprang out of the little Hyundai and yelled, "Hey, Kenny! Hey, Conrad!" A huge grin. "Crash and burn, old buddy!"
"Crash and burn? You're crazy, Kenny. You're going to kill somebody."
The great gangling youth, Kenny, seemed to enjoy that immensely.
"Ah, come on, Conrad. That wasn't nothing but a little four-wheel drift."
"Yeah, right. You're a four-wheel drift. You're a lunatic." Kenny cackled with delight. He was one of those raw-boned young California Okies, to use the local term for redneck, with a neck so big and long his Adam's apple seemed to bob up and down a foot every time he swallowed. His eerily pale blue eyes looked as wild as an Arctic dog's, an impression magnified by his scraggly mustache and two-week growth of beard. He wore a T-shirt advertising an Oakland radio station, KUK. "I don't give a cuck. For nothing but Country Metal 107.3 FM.
Around his midsection was the sort of 6-inch-wide leather belt weightlifters use. His body was all bones and joints and sharp angles, except for his forearms and hands, which were huge, even bigger than Conrad's. The bill of his baseball cap was turned up, revealing the undersurface, upon which was inscribed, in felt marker, "Suicide."
"Brain dead," said Conrad, shaking his head in disgust, but also beginning to smile the reluctant smile you give a child who is naughty but has a certain roguish charm and knows it.
"Now that's sick." "You heard it?"
"Heard it. Did I have a choice? I could have stayed home in Pittsburgh and heard it."
Kenny started cackling again, and the cackle threw him into a cough, and the cough started him snuffling and hawking. And then he spit on the ground and began hopping about and pumping his arms in a type of jerky dance that was in vogue among the country metal headbangers, as they were called. He started singing, or rather sing-songing, rapping, in a nasal voice.
"Gon' put my Jimbo up your shanks akimbo, without no shuckin' words, no mind-suckin' words. You get my meanin', or you want a skull cleanin'. Gon' peel your cap," I said. "Peel 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 your cap," I said, said. "Brain dead, brain dead, brain dead, brain dead."
"Peel your cap," said Conrad. "What's peel your cap supposed to mean?"
"You don't know peel your cap? That's like what they do in an autopsy. They cut the top of your skull off so they can get at your brain. That's called peeling your cap. That's jailhouse talk. They'll say, 'Don't try to get over on me, motherfucker, or I'll peel your cap for you.'"
"Oh, that's terrific," said Conrad, sniffling and then hawking deep in his throat.
"You got any idea how sick that is? I mean, a song about that? That's very sick, Kenny. And you want to know what's even sicker? The fact that you know that piece of garbage by heart."
"What are you talking about? That's by the Puss Casserole. That's their new one. Hey, let me show you something."
"The Puss Casserole?" said Conrad, shaking his head.
Kenny motioned toward his bright red car, and then coughed again and began a snuffling and scuffling so deep in his throat it seemed to reach down into his very lungs. The car was a snub-tailed two-door sports model with Rapier XSI written like a speed blur across the side.
"When'd you get this?" asked Conrad, sneezing, snuffling, hawking, and spitting again.
"Just got it. Let me show you something."
He opened the door, collapsed the back of the front seat forward, and motioned toward the interior. Conrad stuck his head in. There was no back seat. It had been removed. In its place was a sheet of plywood that ran from the base of the front seat to the rear window. Set in the plywood were two enormous stereo speakers.
20-inch speakers, man. Those things got so much temp in 'em, you're sitting there in the front seat and they'll blow the hair around on your head and make your ears flap. God's honest truth. Your ears'll flap and your ribs'll rattle. Those speakers pull so many amps. Let me show you this.
Now he took Conrad around to the rear of the car and opened the trunk. The two young men coughed, snuffled, hawked, and spit in unison. Mounted in the floor of the trunk were a pair of big fans aimed in toward the backs of the speakers and a tangle of wires and equipment.
See those fans? That's to cool 'em off. They pull so many amps without the fans they'd burn up. I'm talking about catch fire.
Conrad stood up and gave Kenny a long, level look.
How much did that cost you, Kenny?
Cost you, Kenny, came out in a wheeze, so he cleared his throat.
The fans?
Everything. The fans, the speakers, the car. He made a motion with his hand. The whole thing.
Oh, AGT paid for it.
He snuffled deeply and spit and rubbed his eye sockets with his fingers. AGT was a finance company well known in Alameda and Contra Costa counties. His watery eyes lit up.
These speakers, you can go boom-bombing with 'em. I already done it.
What bombing?
You know, boom-bombing. That's like when you drive past a bunch of cars and you turn up your sound system to max Q and, like, the vibration set off the car alarms.
The way he said it, Okie style, it sounded like a question.
I was going through Danville coming over here. And you know that section over there with the houses with those big old roofs, slate or tile or whatever it is? I bet you I boomed off 6 or 8 cars. People running out the doors.
Conrad was appalled.
Not with brain dead, I hope. Danville's a nice town.
Kenny smiled and nodded toward Conrad's Hyundai hatchback.
Why don't you fix yours up?
He had a frog in his throat and scuffled it out.
You can fit a couple of 20-inchers in the back of yours, no trouble at all.
Yeah, that'd be real great, Kenny. Why'd I want to take the back seat of my car out? I got a wife and 2 children.
Yeah, well, that's cool.
And why would I want to go boom-bombing in Danville? I like Danville. I want to live in Danville. I'm going to buy a condo in Danville.
He snuffled, swallowed, and gave Kenny's car a wave of dismissal. Here's thousands of dollars you're spending, and for what, Kenny? The only reason I'm working in there in that freezer is to get the down payment on a condo. Soon as we get a condo in Danville, me and Croker Global Foods are history. I'm not even going to come near this place.
Yeah, well, like I say, that's cool.
But you ought to loosen up, Conrad. Loosen up and lighten up.
No, you're wrong, said Conrad. I ought to tighten up.
So should you. You ever listen to yourself, or listen to me, or anybody else who works in the freezer? Everybody's coughing and sneezing and taking pills all night. Everybody's nose is running, and this is Contra Costa County, California. One beautiful, hot, dry day after another. And the whole bunch of us, we sound like... Well, why don't you sit back and listen sometime?
That's nothing but freezer flu, man. Don't mean a thing.
Nothing but freezer flu, huh? Just because there's a little name for it, don't think that makes it any better.
Look, said Kenny, the pay is good, $14 an hour. Where else you gonna get that? Where else you even gonna get a job?
There's no jobs out there, Conrad.
Shit, be happy, crash and burn.
No, Kenny, not crash and burn. You gotta start thinking about where you're gonna be 5 years from now.
5 years from now?
Kenny shook his head.
You say you're going to get a condo in Danville.
Well, lots of luck, old buddy. I hope you do.
but it isn't going to happen from working a job and saving money. Maybe your folks going to help you out.
Conrad laughed without smiling. That's a joke. They hit me up for money.
What makes you think I can't do it?
You ever know anybody did it?
It don't happen. Sooner or later you run into the bald man with the necktie.
What bald man with the necktie?
You don't know Easy Payments? By Snuff Out?
No, I don't know Easy Payments by Snuff Out.
Jesus Christ, Conrad. You never even heard it? You never heard... 9 to 5, you park your butt beneath the bitch box on the wall and lap up all that crap inside the rut they make you crawl. So, yo, go buy your own death, bro, and die on the installment plan, for they cut your nuts and hang you from the necktie on the bald man.
Conrad sighed and gave Kenny a long, serious look.
You know your problem, said Conrad. You actually believe that stuff. You actually take it seriously.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Conrad.
Who do you think writes these songs? Said Conrad. It's people with neckties and suits and big houses in places like Danville, that's who. And they make their money off people like you, and you just let them put all this stupid poison in your brain. You let them put no in your heart.
Take my advice, Kenny. You ought to forget about the pus casserole and snuff out and crash and burn and what was that other one? The child abusers. You ought to stop listening to all that garbage.
And like I said, you ought to lighten up. And like I said, you ought to tighten up.
Conrad tapped his forehead.
A lot of screws loose in there, Kenny.
Conrad turned his back and went over to the Hyundai to pick up his lunch bag from the front seat. And Kenny howled. And the laughter made Conrad realize how many nights had begun this way. Kenny would recite some sick country metal lyrics, or recount some vile, marauding adventure he'd had, and Conrad would register his shock and disapproval and turn his back, and Kenny would find it all enormously amusing. With his determination to lead a serious and orderly life, he was Kenny's perfect straight man, as he knew very well. Here at the warehouse, Kenny was the king of the crash-and-burners, and the crash-and-burners sure did outnumber the straightforward strugglers like himself. He would have liked to bring Mr. Wildrotsky, who taught the American history course at Mount Diablo, a real old 60s type who wore mutton chops and wire-rimmed glasses, and was always talking about the working class and the bourgeoisie, and showing them pictures of coal miners with dirty faces. Wouldn't it be funny to bring old Mr. Wildrotsky over to Croker one night and show him what the working class looked like today, in real life? Bring him over and introduce him to Kenny and the Crash and Burners. The freezer was a warehouse within a warehouse, a vast refrigerated chamber down at one end of the building behind a wall covered in sheets of galvanized metal studded with rivets. A door, big as a barn's, covered in the same galvanized metal and battered as an old bucket, hung from a track. It had been opened for the start of the shift, revealing a curtain of heavy-gauge vinyl clouded by oily smears and shales of ice. The curtain had a slit up the middle so that the workmen could go in and out without too much of the cold air escaping. The freezer was maintained at dead zero Fahrenheit. Inside there were no windows. The chamber remained in an eternal, frigid, gray dusk, 24 hours a day. Stacks of cartons, tons of them, many of them packed with meat and fish, reached up 3 stories high on metal racks. Way up on the ceiling you could make out lengths of gray galvanized metal air-conditioning ducts, doubling back and forth upon themselves like intestines. Between the duct strips of fluorescent tubing emitted a feeble bluish haze. The extreme cold seemed to congeal the very light itself and remove every trace of color. Kenny, Conrad, and some 30 other pickers stood about just inside the entryway, waiting for the shift to start. They were clad in the lumpish, padded, metal-gray Zincolon gloves and freezer suits with Dynel fur collars, the warehouse issued. On the backs of the jackets was written Croker in big yellow letters that looked lemony in the fluorescent light. Beneath the freezer suits they wore so many combinations of long johns, shirts, jerseys, sweaters, insulated vests, and sweatsuits. They were puffed up like blimps or the Michelin tire man. Kenny had the hood of a sweatshirt pulled up over his head, with just the bill of his baseball cap sticking out, upturned and emblazoned suicide. His wild eyes seemed to be beaming out from within a shadowy hole. Three of the freezer pickers were black, three were Chinese, one was Japanese, and one was Mexican. But most were Okies like Kenny, and half the Okies had adopted Kenny's suicide regalia. They were known as the Crashin' Burners, and they called the freezer the Suicidal Freezer Unit, a term Conrad couldn't get out of his head. The way the jets of breath fog streamed from their noses and mouths was the first indication of how cold it actually was. But any picker foolish enough to try to work without his gloves on would soon have another. Each of them operated a pallet jack, a small but heavy electric vehicle, with which you could jack up a loaded pallet and move it to another part of the warehouse. You stood on the back of the jack behind its metal motor housing. It was simple to use. But if you touched the levers or handlebars with your bare hands in this icebox, your flesh would freeze to the metal. And just try pulling it loose. To one side of the entrance was a wooden table manned by the night foreman, Dom. An old fellow. In the freezer, 48 was old, who looked a mile wide in his plaid Hudson Bay jacket. He wore a navy watch cap pulled down over his forehead and ears, which made the top half of his big round head look ridiculously tiny. Bursts of mouth fog pumped out of his mouth as he studied the printout order sheets in front of him. He had a little cylindrical remote microphone clipped to the collar of his jacket. The boys were beginning to feel the cold creep in. It made your nose run even more. A chorus of sniffles, sneezes, snufflings, hawkings, coughs, and spitting welled up. Every now and then some picker would spit right on the floor, which made Conrad's flesh crawl. Dom's deep voice sounded out over the wall speaker system.
"Okay, men. Before we get started, just a couple things. There's good news and bad news. First, the bad news. We've been getting complaints from over at Bolka Rendering that somebody here's been using their parking lot for tailgate parties. Kenny."
"Hey," said Kenny, "why are you looking at me?"
"Why?" said Dom. "Because 2 nights ago, or it was in the morning, the sun was up, and they're coming to work over there, and not only's there a bunch of guys sprawled shit-faced all over their parking lot, but there's some kind of boombox playing this song where they're screaming, 'Eat shit.' Guy tells me that's all you could hear over half of Contra Costa County. 'Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit.' That's really terrific. That's very high class."
"Ooh, ooh, ooh!"
whooped the Crashin' Burners.
"Eat shit?" asked Kenny in a pseudo-startled voice. "Isn't that by the child abusers?"
"Whoever it's by, it's disgusting," boomed Dom's voice over the speaker system. "There's a lot of women go to work at Bolka in the morning. I hope you realize that."
"Ooh, ooh, ooh!"
Now the pickers really let out whoops. Dom's concern for the tender sex, especially in the form it took at the Bolka Rendering Works, struck them as a howl, worthy of maximum derision. Dom shook his head.
"Okay, you can laugh, but if it don't stop, somebody over here is gonna get child abused. Capiche? Okay?"
Lest the whoops start again, he hurried on.
"All right. Now here's the good news. We got a good turnout, and this is the end of the month, and so it looks like a light night. So whenever you men complete the orders, you can get out of here."
Dom always said "you men" when he was appealing to their better natures. More whoops, only now with a note of honest elation. Light nights they loved. Toward the end of the month, many of the hotels and the institutional kitchens that operated on monthly budgets, the prisons, hospitals, nursing homes, company cafeterias, cut back on their orders. On top of that, there had been a general falling off of business. The result was nights like tonight, on which the pickers could work 5, 6, 7 hours and get paid for 8, so long as they got the orders out. The boys converged on the foreman's table to pick up the order printouts, which were stacked in a wire basket. Now the great, dreary chamber was filled with the squeals of rubber-soled boots pivoting on the concrete slab, the whines of the pallet jack's electric motors starting up, the jolts of power hitting the drive shafts, the rumble of the wheels rolling over the concrete floor. Conrad had slipped his order sheet onto the clipboard on his handlebars before he actually focused on what it was. Santa Rita. He ached a little more and rubbed his nose with the back of his glove. Santa Rita, down near the town of Pleasanton, was the Alameda County Jail, one of 8 prisons Croker supplied. Santa Rita orders always went on, and included a lot of heavy cases of cheap meat. He scanned the sheet. 12 cases of beef shanks, Row J, slot 12. Each case weighed 80 pounds. In loading up a pallet, the trick was to put the heaviest cases on the bottom and build up to the lightest. So that was how he'd have to start the night, lifting 0.5 ton of frozen beef shanks in 80-pound bricks. He stood on the back of his pallet jack and squeezed the accelerator levers. With a whine and a jolt, the machine came to life, and he headed down the aisle bearing an empty pallet on the blades before him. The boys were already plunging full decibel into the frenzy of the light night. All over the freezer you could hear whining motors, squealing boots, cries, shouts, oaths, the crashing sound of pickers slinging heavy frozen cartons onto the pallets. They leaned into the rack's icy slots, waddled in, crawled in, swollen gray creatures with dinel fur collars. And then they crawled back out, waddled back out, slithered back out, bearing frozen cartons of food. Fat, gray ice weevils swarming over the racks in a terribly diligent frenzy. And he was one of them. His destination, Row J, slot 12, was deep in the gloom of the freezer. He looked into the slot at floor level and sighed a long jet of breath fog. It was empty. He looked into the slot above it. It was about 1/4 full, with the cartons stacked at the rear of the 2 pallets that formed the slot's floor. So he did the usual. He hopped up on top of the jack's motor housing and hoisted himself into the upper slot on his haunches. The slots were only 4 feet high. He duck-walked across a pallet toward the cartons stacked in the rear. The pallet slats sagged in a weary, spongy way beneath his feet. He sank to his knees, hooked his hand over a carton in the uppermost row, let his body flop down on the icy blocks beneath him, and started pulling. It wouldn't budge. It seemed to be frozen fast between the cartons on either side. He started yanking on it. Grunts. Bursts of mouth fog. It was dark in here, inside this cliff of ice. He struggled to rock the carton free. The pressure on his fingers, his forearm, his elbow and shoulder was tremendous. His eyes started watering, and the rims of his eyelids began to burn. Finally, with a hot burst of fog, he yanked the carton loose and began pulling it toward him. He got off his knees and rose up in a crouch once more. Then he went into a deep squat and tried to pick up this frozen 80-pound dead weight without straining his back. Since he couldn't straighten up, he had to pull the carton in toward his midsection and duck-waddle to the mouth of the slot. 80 pounds, frozen solid, more than half his own weight. Already his shoulders, his arms, his hands, his lower back, the big muscles of his thighs were in agony. Despite the frigid temperature, his cheeks and forehead were hot from the exertion. At the edge of the slot he set the carton down, slid the 4 feet to the floor below, and grabbed the carton in a bear hug. For an instant he staggered before getting his feet squarely under the weight. Then he squatted again and lowered the carton onto the pallet on the front of his jack. When he stood up, a jolt of pain went through his lower back. He glanced down. Blearily, in the periphery of his vision, he could see little glints and sparkles. Ice crystals were forming in his mustache. Sweat had run off his face, and mucus had flowed from his nose. And now his mustache was beginning to freeze up. He took the glove off his right hand and ran his fingers through his hair. There were little icicles in the hair on his head and in his eyebrows, and a regular little stalactite had formed on the end of his nose. He looked at his hand. He made a fist. Then he undid it and splayed his fingers out and turned them this way and that. They were extraordinarily broad, his fingers. From yanking and carrying the 80-pound carton, they were pumped up, bulging with little muscles. They were stupendous and grotesque at the same time. His hand looked as if it belonged to someone twice his size. He stood still for a moment. The noise in the freezer had risen to a merry old ruckus. The whines of the jacks came from every direction, the crashes of product hitting the pallets, the shouts, the cries.
"Crash and burn!"
The unmistakable, high nasal cry of Kenny himself, somewhere a few rows away.
"Crash and burn!"
sang Kenny's boys with the suicide caps in a choral response. Backing out of a slot nearby, here came a fat, gray ice weevil wearing a Panzer helmet. Herbie Jonah was his name. He had a huge carton hugged into his abdomen. Jets of fog came out of his mouth with a regular beat. Conrad couldn't hear him, but he knew exactly what he was saying, because Herbie said the same thing all night long as he struggled with the frozen blocks. "Motherfucker! Motherfucker! Motherfucker!" Over there on the aisle, sailing past on his pallet jack at a real crash-and-burn clip, came a wiry little crash-and-burner known as Lightbulb, his suicide cap jammed down practically over his eyes, the hood of his sweatshirt sticking up with a funny point above the top of his head, as if he were an elf. For someone so small, he was amazingly strong. The pallet on the front of his jack was already piled high with product.
"Crash and burn!"
Kenny sang out from somewhere, this time in falsetto. And Lightbulb, perched on the back of his pallet jack, threw back his head and gave a falsetto yodel of his own.
"Crash and burn!"
and zipped past. Suddenly Dom's deep voice was bellowing over the speakers. "Clean up! Clean up! Betty Four, Betty Four, clean up, chop, chop!" This meant a spill had occurred. Betty Four was row B, slot four. Some product had slid off a pallet as it went around a curve, or some picker had dropped something from an upper slot, or an entire jack, picker, pallet, and all, had turned over, and product was spilled on the floor. Clean up was not a verb but a noun, a job category. There were two clean-ups, two Filipinos, known as Ferdy and Birdy, both of them too small to be pickers, who did nothing but clean up product that spilled or got smashed on the concrete slab. There would be plenty of spills tonight. There were plenty of them every light night, as the boys yahooed through the frozen phosphorescent haze in the name of the god of the suicidal freezer unit, testosterone. Conrad listened to the crazy din of his mates, and then caught himself. He was letting no creep into his heart. What he was doing in this place had nothing to do with jacks and slots and pallets and product, or with crashing and burning. It had to do with a new life for his young family. With a deep breath, a sigh, and a long jet of breath fog, he hopped back up on the motor housing of his pallet jack and hoisted himself back into the upper slot. A weevil with yes in his heart, he burrowed back into the cliff for 11 more 80-pound blocks of frozen beef shanks. The evening had just begun. By the time he had loaded all 12 cartons onto the pallet on the front of his jack, his face was burning up, and his mustache was so full of ice he could feel its weight pulling at his skin. Quickly he scanned the printout again. 24 cases of beef patties. Hadn't even noticed that. Row D, slot 21. 50 pounds apiece. Didn't help to dwell on it. He headed off on the jack, bearing the 12 cases of beef shanks on the pallet before him. Down the aisle sailed Kenny, standing up on the back of his pallet jack. His eyes burned crazily in the shadow beneath his suicide brim and the sweatshirt hood. The pallet on the front of his jack seemed to be more than half-loaded already. As soon as he saw Conrad coming toward him, he broke into a big grin and yelled out, "Yo! Whoa!" Conrad released his accelerator lever and drifted to a stop, and Kenny pulled up beside him. "Yo, Conrad, what the hell's happened to your mustache?" "What do you mean?" said Conrad. Kenny's own mustache was heavily flecked with frost. "It's fucking turned to ice," said Kenny. "You look like you got a couple of icicles hanging out your nose." Conrad pulled the glove off his right hand. It was true. His mustache was frozen solid from his nostrils to where it dropped down on either side of his mouth. "I swear to God," said Kenny, "looks exactly like a couple icicles hanging out your nose. What have you been doing?" Conrad gestured toward the cartons of beef shanks on his pallet. "Santa Rita," he said. Kenny said, "Like lifting the QE2, isn't it?" With that, he shot a whining jolt of electricity to his drive shaft and sped on down the aisle. Conrad burrowed on, a weevil with the best of them, into the Salisbury steaks, fish burgers, gravy stock, ice cream, orange juice, cut fava beans, American cheese, margarine, pepperoni pizza, chipped beef, bacon and waffles, and the ruckus rose, and the cries rang out, "Crash and burn!" And the product crashed, and the pickers yahooed, and Dom's big voice bellowed over the speakers, "Clean up! Clean up! Kilo 9! Kilo 9! Come on, Ferdy! You too, Bertie! On the double!" And the light-night frenzy ran through the chamber like a rogue hormone. As soon as he retrieved the final item on the Santa Rita printout, a dozen cases of frozen buckwheat waffles, Conrad rubbed his nose with his glove to break up the rings of ice that had formed inside his nostrils. A thick, restless fog was beginning to roil around the tops of the racks from the heat of the machinery and the bodies of the struggling human beings. The fluorescent tubing gave off a wan, tubercular blue glimmer behind it. Conrad's pallet was piled perilously high with product. He eased the jack toward the freezer door. He pulled a handle hanging from a chain, and the door rolled open hydraulically. Slowly he drove through the slit in the vinyl curtain and out onto the dock's concrete apron. As soon as he emerged from the freezer, he was engulfed, overwhelmed, by heat. The temperature out here was still well up into the 80s. The trucks were roaring and sighing. A few were already pulling out for the nightly delivery runs. All up and down the platform were great heaps of cartons, drums, canisters, sacks, resting on pallets the pickers had deposited. He could feel the ice melting from his hair and his eyebrows and his mustache and streaming down his face. What must he look like to the loaders and the drivers and everyone else out here in the real world? A poor, encrusted weevil emerging from the polar depths, a mutant, bleary-eyed, blinking its way into a sweltering California night. He straightened up in an instinctive bid for dignity. And yet, when he deposited the pallet and its prodigious load at Bay 17, neither the checker, nor the loaders, nor the driver seemed to take any special notice of him. They were used to such creatures, the gray weevils who came crawling out from under the ice. Before heading back into the freezer, Conrad got off the jack and stood and stretched. His long johns were soaked clear through from humping product for so long without a break. He gazed out beyond the big white croaker trucks and the glare of the loading platform, out beyond the parking lot and the flatlands and the marshes. There was such a profusion of stars. They seemed to be swelling and surging in the sky. Below them, near the horizon, he could see other lights twinkling. San Francisco, Sausalito, Tiburon, he guessed it was, just across the bay. And so far off. Might as well be another continent. What were people his age, 23, doing over there, at this moment, beneath that exuberant, starry sky? He couldn't even imagine it. And he steeled himself against submitting to such an idle exercise, for that would be inviting no into his heart. The leafy town of Danville, in Contra Costa County, was as near to the fabled coast of California as he cared, or dared, to aspire. With a great effort he beckoned yes back into his heart. It was slow in coming. Just before Conrad reached the entrance to go back into the freezer, there was a tremendous clatter. A picker from the warehouse's main section, Dry Foods, pulled up ahead of him driving an electric truck known as a tugger, pulling three metal wagons piled high with product. Drums of detergent, canisters of tomato paste, sacks of pinto beans, huge jugs of red food dye. There was no end to it. The tugger had a seat like a golf cart's, and perched on it was a chubby, red-headed fellow, no older than Conrad himself, wearing a short-sleeved sport shirt, work gloves, and crepe-soled boots. The dry foods pickers sometimes drew orders with one or two frozen items, and were told to just go into the freezer and get them. They weren't dressed for it, but they could take it for the few minutes they might have to be in there. This one, the chubby redhead, was studying the freezer's huge door. He couldn't figure out how to open it. Conrad drove up beside him and pointed to the chain, and then pulled it for him. As the door rolled open, he gestured toward the slit in the vinyl curtain as if to say, "After you." The redhead eased his tugger and his wagons on through, and Conrad entered behind him. The light night ruckus had not died down for a moment. Shouts, oaths, crashing sounds, whines, and Kenny's voice singing out through the icy haze and the roiling fog.
"Crash and burn! Crash and burn!"
answered the crash and burners from every aisle, every row, every rack, every icy, hazy, fog-bound corner. Baffled, the boy on the tugger swiveled his head this way and that. All at once he took off for the racks, his tugger whining shrilly from all the juice he was feeding it. Conrad drove his jack over to the foreman's desk. Kenny was standing there beside his jack studying a printout he had just picked up.
"Shit," he said to nobody in particular.
Then he caught sight of Conrad and held up the sheet and said, "Nat and Nate's," and made a face.
Nat and Nate's was a big old delicatessen in San Francisco just south of Market Street. The pickers hated Nat and Nate's orders because of the heavy cases of processed meat. Conrad pulled a printout from the wire basket. Morden Rehabilitation, up in Santa Rosa. He scanned the sheet. Shouldn't be too bad an order. He got up on the pallet jack and drove into the canyons amid the ice cliffs. He soon found himself humping product just one slot away from Kenny. He could hear Kenny grunting and swearing to himself. Conrad was loading a case of spare ribs on his jack when Kenny emerged from the cliff embracing an 80-pound carton of processed turkey. All at once, there was a sharp whine and a terrific clattering. Here came the red-headed dry foods picker, barreling out of a row on his tugger and pulling his three wagons full of product. He turned to go up the aisle. He was turning too fast. Instead of straightening out, he kept on turning in a huge, crazy arc. The centrifugal force sent the wagons up on two wheels. They were going over. A massive gush of product hit the slick concrete of the aisle. A huge sack split open. Pellets! No, pinto beans, streaming in every direction. Hard and smooth and slippery as ball bearings they were. A loaded pallet jack came speeding up the aisle from behind. Panzer helmet. Herbie Jonah. Herbie veered to keep from crashing into the spill. His jack hit the streaming pinto beans, skidded, then went into a ferocious spin. Herbie, the jack, the loaded pallet, spinning, flinging frozen product in every direction, careening straight toward Kenny, who had his back turned with an 80-pound block of frozen meat clutched to his midsection.
"Kenny!"
Herbie, screaming, trying to keep his grip on the handlebars of the jack. Bango! He was thrown off. He hit the floor. The floor turned red. Red! Kenny turned his head. He could see Herbie's jack coming straight at him, but he was frozen by his own compulsive grip on the carton. Conrad sprang forward, dove at Kenny head first, bowled him over. A tremendous suffocating crash enveloped their bodies. A sea of red. They went sliding through a blood-red muck on the pinto beans. Kenny and Conrad. A tangle of arms and legs. Racks and cartons wheeling overhead in the roiling fog. The moment stretched out endlessly and then stopped. Conrad was upside down on his head and his right shoulder, looking up at his legs, which were red. Jackknifed over Kenny's body, covered in my blood? Slowly, not at all sure that he could, he rolled his legs off Kenny. Everywhere, red, hemorrhaging. But he couldn't figure out where he was cut. Kenny, lying next to him, contorted, seemed to be trying to roll over on his back. Cartons, drums, canisters, sacks were strewn about in the horrible red muck. A Panzer helmet, a body, a gray weevil, Herbie Jonah, smeared red. Herbie tried to sit up, but the heel of his hand skidded on the pinto beans, and he flopped back down into the red muck again. There was Herbie's pallet jack, smashed into Kenny's. The motor housing of Kenny's was ripped off its base. The levers of the two machines were twisted about each other. The slats on the two pallets were snapped into huge splinters. Both machines were jammed against one of the black metal uprights of the racks. Out in the middle of the aisle, all three of the dry food pickers' wagons were turned over. But the tugger itself was still upright, nosed into the row on the other side. And the chubby redhead was still on his seat, slumped over toward his handlebars and moaning. One of the black pickers, Tony Chase, came running toward Conrad and Kenny. Suddenly his legs went out from under him, the pinto beans. He landed in the red muck. Conrad managed to get up to a kneeling position. He could feel the pinto beans, hard as marbles, rolling underneath his knees. His Zincolon suit was dripping red. Blood. But wait a minute. Blood wouldn't look like this. couldn't possibly remain this bright. Then he saw them, two shattered 10-gallon jugs, red food dye, the jugs and the pinto beans, a flash flood of the stuff.
Can't get my hand.
It was the dry foods picker, still hunched over the handlebars of his tugger, moaning,
"Can't get my hand."
Somehow the boy had taken the glove off his right hand and neglected to put it back on before he took hold of the handlebars to steer his tugger into the turn, and his fingers and his palm had frozen to the metal. Kenny was sitting up, staring at the wreckage of the two jacks. It was pretty obvious. If he had stayed where he was, squatting down beside his jack with the carton of frozen turkey in his arms, he would have been crushed. Conrad's diving tackle had knocked him toward the aisle. Conrad had thrown his own body directly into the path of Herbie's careening jack. Had his legs been 6 inches higher as he dove, they would have been crushed as the two motor housings smashed together. Had they been 6 inches lower, they would have been crushed by the scythe-like swing of Herbie's palate. The manic light had gone out in Kenny's wild blue eyes. Pickers were converging upon the spill. Kenny opened his mouth, but no words came out. From above, Dom's voice over the speakers.
"Clean up, clean up. Whiskey 8, whiskey 8. Chop, chop. Birdie, Ferdy, both of you. On the double. Got a whole aisle out over here. Whiskey 8, whiskey 8.
And then Kenny, still sitting in the red muck, spoke more softly than Conrad had ever heard him speak before.
"Jesus Christ, Conrad, you just saved my life."
The two clean-ups, Ferdy and Birdie, earned their pay this time, all right. There must have been a ton of product strewn about in the aisle and row W, split open, staved in, mashed, crushed, all of it beginning to freeze to the floor in an icy red slush. It was a miracle that no one was badly hurt. The padded freezer suits saved them, probably, the suits and all the other stuff they swaddled themselves in. The worst off was the chubby redhead from Dry Foods who, sure enough, had ripped a chunk of flesh off his hand, trying to remove it from the handlebar. The pickers who had hit the deck looked a lot worse than he did, however. They looked like survivors of a bomb explosion. There was red dye smeared all over their Zincalon jumpsuits, their gloves, their heads, their faces. Half of Conrad's hair was soaked with the dye. So was Herbie's. One side of Kenny's mustache was a sopping red. It looked as if he had been shot in the nostril. Dom came over and took the whole bunch of them out to the loading platform to give them a break, let them warm up, and see if they were okay.
God almighty!
The checkers and the loaders looked at them now, all right. The muck had frozen to their freezer suits, and it was melting. The suits seemed to be oozing and festering blood. Every now and then a pinto bean would fall off, looking like a bloody clot. Conrad began to shiver, right out here in the stifling heat. He'd almost gotten killed, or maimed. Him and Kenny both. Kenny was abnormally quiet. He stuck by Conrad's side. He'd start to talk about what had happened, and he'd say,
I guess,
or something equally vague, and his eyes would look as if they were pinned on something a mile away. And then Herbie came over and told Kenny he was truly sorry, but there had been no way he could control his jack once it hit the pinto beans. It seemed so strange because nobody had ever heard Herbie express anything approaching a tender sentiment before.
"Oh, I know that," said Kenny. "I heard you yell and I saw the goddamn thing coming at me, and I just froze. I had that goddamn carton of processed turkey in my hands, and I couldn't even drop it or nothing. I just froze. If this character here—"
He nodded toward Conrad and smiled faintly. And then that smile, too, died on his lips, and he got the far-off look again. Dom came over and told the boys that the lunch break was coming pretty soon, and they might as well stay out here until the horn sounded and go straight into lunch. Then he drew Conrad aside and put his arm around his shoulders and said,
You okay? You showed us something in there, kid.
Conrad didn't know what to say except that he was, in fact, okay. He was still too shaken to take any pleasure in the compliment. The lunch break was at 12:30 a.m., in what was known as the break room, which was nothing but a clearing in the main work bay, dry foods, with 4-by-8-foot sheets of raw plywood serving as walls. The freezer pickers had taken off their Zincalon freezer suits, the thermal vests, the hats and gloves, and wadding and swaddling, and were sitting in plastic chairs at the break room's heavy-duty folding tables. Stripped down to shirts and jeans again, they looked whipped and clammy from lifting so much product at such a furious pace and sweating so much inside their insulation. Kenny was slumped back in a chair right across the table from Conrad. Conrad had just opened his paper bag and taken out one of the 2 meatloaf sandwiches Jill had fixed him. A couple of dozen pickers carrying their igloo coolers were lined up waiting to cook their lunches in the microwave ovens over by the plywood walls. They kept turning their heads and looking at him. He figured it was because he and Kenny presented such a spectacle, smeared red the way they were. Light bulb came over from the microwave with a steaming plastic picnic plate and sat down and said,
"Jesus Christ! How you guys doin'? You okay?"
Lightbulb stuttered, but he stuttered on the vowels rather than the consonants. By the time he reached the "okay," the little crash and burner was no longer looking at both of them, but squarely at him, Conrad. He had a glistening look on his face. Conrad could feel himself blushing. For the first time, he let the thought form in his mind. "They all think I'm some kind of hero." The notion was not exhilarating. On the contrary, he felt like a fraud. When he dove at Kenny, it had not been an act of calculated bravery in the teeth of dreadful, well-known odds. He had just done it in a moment of terror. And he was still terrified. "I could have been killed in there." That he shared these guilty, submerged, utterly inexpressible feelings with most of the heroes of history, he had no way of knowing. Just then, to his great relief, the warehouse's assistant night manager, Nick Derdosian, came into the break room with a burnt orange manila folder cradled in his arms. In the folder would be the paychecks, and everybody would have something else to think about. Derdosian was a swarthy man in his mid-30s. The top of his head was bald, but the rest of him was remarkably hairy. A heavy crop of black hair emerged from the short sleeves of his shirt and ran all the way down his arms and out onto the backs of his hands. Thanks to Kenny, the freezer pickers all called him Nick Necktie. He and the other supervisory personnel and salesmen had offices up in the front of the warehouse, overlooking East Bay Boulevard. Kenny referred to them collectively as the neckties. Most of the men up in the front office did, in fact, wear neckties, as did Derdosian, until recently. Every time he turned up in the break room or the work bays, Kenny had taken to yelling out, "Nick Necktie!" And some crash and burner or other would echo the cry in falsetto, "Nick Necktie!" This finally so rattled Derdosian, a quiet, stolid man whom God had not designed for dealing with crash and burners. He had lately abandoned his necktie and started wearing open-necked shirts. But he was so hairy, a carpet of crinkly chest hairs was visible in the V of the open neck. And Kenny and the crash and burners had started calling him Harry No Tie.
"Harry No Tie!"
So this week he had put the necktie back on and taken to approaching the crew with a necktie and a tense, ingratiating grin. Tonight, however, he came into the break room without any smile at all. Tonight he looked gloomy and wary, as if he thought perhaps Kenny had dreamed up some new way of making his life miserable. Instead, Kenny merely nodded and said, "Hi, Nick." He looked every bit as glum himself. Derdozian set the manila folder down on a nearby table, removed the stack of paychecks, and started calling out the names in alphabetical order. Conrad took his envelope without bothering to open it, folded it in two, put it in the pocket of his plaid shirt, and went back to the table. Just then, voices erupted at the next table. It was Tony Chase and the other two black pickers. Tony was showing them a white slip of paper and talking angrily. Lightbulb swung around to listen, then leaned forward again.
"Jesus Christ," he said. "Honig just got notified. He's been laid off."
Conrad sat upright. Tony had been hired the same week he was. Kenny and Lightbulb already had their envelopes out and were going through them to see if there was anything other than a check inside. Evidently they were safe. They hadn't been laid off. The same thing was going on all over the break room. From somewhere behind him, Conrad heard a voice gasp out,
"Fuck a duck!"
Slowly Conrad withdrew his envelope from his shirt pocket and slipped his big forefinger under the flap and ripped it open. There was the salmon-colored paycheck, as usual. Behind it was a white slip of paper. He read the first few words. "Due to a necessary capacity reduction in this facility, your services..." Then he looked up. Kenny and Lightbulb were staring at him. He couldn't make himself speak. He could only nod up and down to tell them, "Yes, it's true."
"I don't fucking believe this," said Kenny.
Lunging, he stretched his arm across the table and said,
"Let me see that,"
and snatched the slip of paper from Conrad's hand and studied it for a moment. Then he bolted out of his seat. The chair hit the floor behind him with a loud plastic smack. Glaring at the retreating figure of Derdozian, he called out,
"Yo! Nick!"
Derdozian stopped in the entryway to the break room. Immediately his head began to jiggle from side to side as if to say, "I had nothing to do with it."
"What the hell's going on, Nick?"
Kenny's huge hands were pressed down on the surface of the table, supporting the weight of his upper body. His chin jutted forward. Every striation of the muscles of his great long neck stood out. He looked as if he were about to spring all the way from there to the opening in the plywood wall where the cowering assistant night manager stood. His wild dog eyes bored in, demanding a response. And then they opened wide, and he screamed out,
"Who's the bright boy thought this up, Nick?"
You could still hear the clatter and banging of the dry foods bay beyond, but here in the break room there wasn't another sound. The crew froze stock still, riveted by this outburst of crash-and-burner fury.
"Who's the shit for brains, Nick? You're laying off Conrad? You're laying off the best men in this whole fucking place?"
Derdozian, transfixed, slowly lifted his shoulders and then the palms of his hands and lowered his head, in the gesture that pleads,
"It wasn't me. I don't make these decisions." "He was gonna buy a condo, Nick. He's got a wife and two kids. He's got heart, Nick. He's got heart. He's worth more than a whole bunch of you fucking neckties put together."
The assistant night manager now had his palms up so high, and his head down so low, he looked as if he were trying to disappear into his own thoracic cavity.
"Oh, I know, Nick. You only work here. You're so fucking pathetic. You know that? So why don't you fucking go get lost? What's the name of the asshole that owns this fucking company? Somebody Croker? Is he the bright boy? Then he'd better fucking get lost too, or I'm gonna..."
Kenny's voice broke, and he lowered his gaze and looked not at Nick Derdozian, but at Conrad. He compressed his lips, which began to tremble, as did his chin. His eyes opened wide, and then he closed them slowly. When he opened them again, they were brimming with tears, which began to roll down his cheeks. Still supporting himself on the table with one hand, he raised the other and covered his face. He lowered his head, and his bony frame began convulsing all the way from his shoulders down to his weightlifter's belt. Conrad's eyes fastened on the most insignificant thing. Kenny's pale blonde hair, wet, stringy, matted down, was already thinning badly in the crown. All at once the indomitable Crash and Burner looked so weak and weary. Kenny raised his head and tried to wipe his tears away with his hand, and then with his forearm. He forced a smile.
"See, I was right, wasn't I, old buddy? They just ain't gonna let you do it. And you were right, too. You said I got no in my heart. And that's the truth. I got no in my heart."
He clutched his throat with his forefinger and thumb.
"I got it up to here, from lapping up all that crap inside the rut they make you crawl in."
Chapter 6